From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we've been following what's happening in the impeachment inquiry. But today, the story is about what didn't happen. This morning, the Trump administration blocked the U.S. ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, from testifying before Congress. Here's Chairman Adam Schiff speaking to reporters a few hours ago about that and documents the White House hasn't produced.
The failure to produce this witness, the failure to produce these documents, we consider yet additional strong evidence of obstruction of the constitutional functions of Congress, a co-equal branch of government.
And now Democrats say they are issuing a subpoena to compel Sondland to appear and hand over relevant documents. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales is here. And Claudia, so the State Department has told Sondland he can't testify. Sondland's lawyers say he's willing to. So a subpoena there. Schiff said obstruction. Other Democrats are saying cover-up. What's next?
So now we understand that the committee is issuing subpoenas for Sondland's testimony and documents. What they want to know is his exchanges involving this call between the president, President Trump, and the president of Ukraine, and concerns that Trump was pressuring this Ukrainian president to investigate Trump's political opponent, Joe Biden, in exchange for military aid. Mm-hmm. So the intelligence panel says they're now seeking these subpoenas. They're still seeking Sondland's testimony in addition to other witnesses. And in the meantime, when these documents or witnesses don't turn up, they're considering it evidence in their investigation and proof of obstruction.
And we remind people that Gordon Sondland was in those text messages last week that were released appearing to not want to talk on incriminating texts with another official who was worried that the president was looking to trade aid to Ukraine for security assistance for political favor. But Sondland is technically the U.S. ambassador to the EU. Ukraine isn't part of the EU.
Right.
So why is he even involved with Ukraine?
Right. Yes. Sondland is an interesting figure. He actually started out as not a Trump fan. He backed out of a fundraising event when Trump was running for president. But that changed. That didn't last long. And he became a Trump donor. He donated $1 million to Trump's inauguration. And soon after that, he became a political appointee to the European Union. His relationship with Trump grew and his role grew. And eventually he was a key figure in these talks between Ukraine and President Trump.
Yeah. Well, we should note, too, that the House plans to hear testimony this week from former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, whom Trump recalled from her post. He criticized her, people remember, in that call to the Ukrainian president. So is there a sense with this blocking today that that will be blocked as well?
There are suspicions that she could be blocked as well, looking at how everything turned out today. Sondland was expected to testify until just a few moments before the State Department and others stepped in to block that. So there are some questions whether she will be allowed to testify mm-hmm. before the panel.
Well, Adam Schiff spoke this morning, and then House Republicans called on Democrats to release the full transcripts of last week's closed-door testimony, including from the former special envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker, in which those Sondland texts surfaced, as we mentioned. Now, at that time, Fox News anchor Chris Wallace said that Volker's opening statement alone was devastating to President Trump and Rudy Giuliani. But here's Republican Mark Meadows speaking to reporters today.
Is there a single journalist here that doesn't want to see the full transcript of Ambassador Volker's testimony?
I agree,
and the American people agree with every one of you. Let them judge for themselves. Whoa. That's what we need to do.
No, we should note that the journalists in the room didn't necessarily right. agree with Meadows that they wanted to see right. the transcripts. But why do Republicans want that public in about the minute we have?
Well, they say that there's additional testimony by Volker that shows to blow a hole, if you will, in the Democrats' narrative when it comes to this impeachment investigation. We got a little snippet of that. They point to Sondland's text messages that were revealed where he said that President Trump had been crystal clear there was no quid pro quo of any kind when it came to these talks with the Ukrainian mm-hmm. president. So they think there's more of that in that transcript that could be released.
It shall be unfolded. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, if you're old enough to remember the Clinton impeachment, this impeachment inquiry isn't your first rodeo. But what about high school students who weren't born in the 90s? How are they digesting this news? John Speicher joins us now. He's a government teacher at Putnam City High School in Oklahoma City. He's been teaching his students about impeachment and the process. Welcome.
Good to be here.
What kind of things do you do in the classroom to teach the students about the impeachment process?
I'll make them look up the word impeachment. That's where it starts. Then I'll have them whip out. I get them a pocket constitution. They also have a constitution available to them in the textbook. I make them find the impeachment. Then I make them find out when it's occurred, for what charges, what was the turnout from the House of Representatives on the indictment, and what was the turnout on the conviction. They're very good about it, and it's great when you see 30 students that are really, really into the lesson for 50 minutes. They want to know what's going on.
What are they asking? What kind of questions are they asking?
Well, what is the impeachment process? And there is a lack of information in general, not just from the students, but from people in general, that they just don't understand that impeachment is an indictment. So there's a lot of misconceptions.
What kind of misconceptions?
Well, primarily that the impeachment is all you need, the indictment from the House of Representatives. But you need a conviction as well to be removed from office. People don't understand that.
Is it difficult to talk about politics with your students?
You know, a lot of people find it difficult. I don't. The facts are the facts. I try not to parse my political biases because we all have them. I try to give them the information. I allow them to think things through. They're a lot smarter than we give them credit for. As a matter of fact, they're brilliant in their curiosity and their inquiry.
And what do they think of what's happening in Washington right now?
Well, they see it as polarized. They see that conversations may not be happening. And I'm there to provide just the information and allow them to make sense of this world, because they are adults next year. For all intents and purposes, they are the adults that are going to, well, they are future.
Do you think they're going to vote in the election next year?
I hope so. Last 2 years, I registered 700 voters, and I will probably register. I've already had about 120 registered this year. So yes, I hope they want to do it. They sound excited about it. So I'm excited that they're going to use their powers.
Are they hopeful about the future of the country?
You know, at times they may not appear to be. They may appear to be a little dismal on it, and I understand why. They're surrounded with pessimistic news. Some of them are like that. But this is, I have to reassure them, and there's a lot of great educators out there that do. This is your future. You are a small percentage of our population, but you are 100% of our future. And the things that we can solve from the baby boomers and from the Gen X, it's up to you. And I have confidence you can do it.
Let's talk about Oklahoma's civics curriculum for a second. The state requires students to take a year-long history course, but only half a year of government. It also requires an exam for history, not for government. You think there should be more mandated civics education at the high school level?
I think it needs to start about seventh or eighth grade, just in exposure, understanding the documents that we were based on, or how our government works, a very unique government. I think we need to probably do about a year and a half to 2 years on this and have a test. We have a citizenship test for people who come to this country, but for the citizens that are here, they could not pass that same exam.
Mm-hmm. You know, what I find interesting is you're teaching high school seniors who weren't even alive when President Clinton was impeached in the 90s.
Yeah, I find that there's things that I talk about and I go, wow, in retrospect, we talk about 9/11 or we talk about other things and how the country has changed over time. And I think to myself, I talked to them about a decade ago. This happened a decade ago. They were seven. They were playing with G.I. Joes or Fortnite or whatever was going on at that time, I suppose.
Right.
But I have to be, you know, I have to be very careful to keep it relevant and keep it contemporary.
Okay, so right now you're talking to an audience of all ages across the country. What would you want people to know about impeachment from the civic side?
From the civic side, allow the process to happen. Allow the evidence to come forth. If there is, it's part of the checks and balances. It's one of the greatest things that our country created. We separated a power from a king. We put into three distinct areas so he couldn't create the law, execute the law, and then tell you if it was fair or judicial or not. So we have this process to keep overzealous executives and other civil leaders in check. And this is the process that has worked. Believe in it. Allow this impeachment process to occur. It's keeping our Constitution alive. This, without a check and balance, power falls into one area, and that's always, always dangerous.
That's John Speicher, who's a government teacher at Putnam City High School in Oklahoma City. He's been teaching his students about the impeachment process. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Mr. Hobson.
On this season of Rough Translation from NPR,
yeah,
we are following people who break the rules.
I mean, lying is part of the business.
In my opinion, the best revenge against ISIS is to be humane.
Am I supposed to punch her? Yeah.
New episodes every other Wednesday. Subscribe.
Our next guest did something that you almost certainly have never done. Last year, journalist Chris Moody was laid off from his job at CNN in New York, so he and his wife moved out of their apartment, sold most of their belongings, and turned a van into a tiny house with solar panels on top to take a journey across North America.
We decided that instead of staying in New York City, we would build our own off-grid tiny house inside of a cargo van and travel around the country to try to find stories about people beyond the anxious cities of the Northeast, especially after looking at data that showed that while the stock market is skyrocketing and the economy is doing very well in the United States right now, that depression, anxiety, and loneliness rates are also incredibly high. And mm-hmm. we wanted to find out if there's anyone out there that's living better. Then we needed to find out how to do that. And that is where the idea of the van came in.
Well, and tell me what the van looked like inside and out.
On the outside, it looks just like a carpenter or a plumber's van. It's a Ram ProMaster high top, one of those that you see driving down the street, often making deliveries. The post office uses these vans. Mm-hmm. And on inside is a kitchen, a bathroom, a bed that becomes a couch, and all powered through solar and a water containment system. And we had no previous experience in building. I'd never held a power tool in my hand. And because of YouTube and Instagram and a lot of communities that are sharing ideas about how to build things like this, we pieced it together in 1 month. Now, we did have some help. Christy's father is an electrical engineer, and he helped us figure out the solar, which I will say is the trickiest part. But after a month, we were ready in our self-built little house, and we hit the road.
And where did you go?
We traveled about 35,000 miles across 40 states. What really dictated where we went was largely the weather. We had no heat or air conditioning in the back. And so when it got hot, we had to go up. And when it got warm, we had to go down. So we traveled all across the U.S. and Canada. Also, we were visiting communities around the country that were trying to live intentionally, people that are also living in tiny houses, minimalists, people that build their own homes and living a lot more free lives.
You found a lot of those people?
We did, all across the country, because you see right now is a fascinating time because the way technology has improved, it has connected people across the country that can share ideas about how to live a little bit differently in the United States. I don't know about you, but I grew up thinking there was only a handful of ways that you were supposed to live. You're supposed to get a job and get a mortgage and fill it with stuff, and that was a fulfillment of the American dream. We found that there are so many more definitions of what the American dream means. It's not just measured by material success. It can be measured by time or time with family or doing what you love. And people all across this country, I would say, have cracked the code or experimenting with redefining what it means to live that American dream and not the one that was maybe set by previous generations.
Because they don't have access to that old-fashioned American dream or because they want to live this new American dream?
It can be a mixture of both. We encountered many different types of communities. On one hand, you have people that are pushed out by the system, whether it's for economic reasons or housing prices are skyrocketing. And then you have other people who have a set of values that they sincerely want to live by, let's say minimalism, the tiny house people. And they pursue that by giving up all of their stuff. You know, like us, we sold or gave away almost all of our things. And we have found that by having less stuff, it gives us more time together and arguably more freedom in the future.
Did you talk politics with people?
This is so fascinating because I used to be a political reporter, and I traveled around the country a lot. And I was the one that always had to bring up politics as the political reporter. And I found that on this trip, if I allowed other people to talk about what they wanted to, politics did not come up much at all. And by that, I mean Washington, D.C.-based federal politics. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear the words Donald Trump or Russia for about a year from people when I let them talk about their own passions. But I did talk to people about local issues. And a lot of times, for people that are trying to live a little bit differently, politics does become an issue and doesn't allow you to build in the way you will. And I'll give you an example. In Austin, Texas, there was a man who wanted to do tiny houses for the homeless in the city. And he had a lot of trouble getting through zoning and through locals who didn't want that in their community. And he found that he had to go just outside city limits and build what he wanted there, where the zoning rules were a lot different. And that is where politics often doesn't necessarily work very well with alternate ways of living. It can be a very sticky situation.
You traveled, as you said, all over the country to about 40 states. What was your favorite place? What was the place you would have stayed if you could?
You know, we fell in love with northern New Mexico, Santa Fe and north. It looks a lot like parts of Colorado, but there are a lot less people there. And there we encountered a group that has built the largest off-grid subdivision in the nation. Hmm. They're building homes out of largely recycled materials. And the homes essentially are self-sustaining, and they provide water, heat, electricity, all through solar and different systems that we've built. And after we encountered some time with them in northern New Mexico, we actually traveled with them to Puerto Rico to build a self-sustaining off-grid compound for victims of Hurricane Maria. And we spent time with them experimenting with how could you build a hurricane-resistant home that provides water and electricity for people vulnerable to increasing weather patterns and climate patterns? How could we get them access to fresh food and water and electricity shortly after a storm and not, in some people's cases, several months?
It sounds like you sort of discovered things that were important that you didn't realize before in your old life in New York City.
That's true. In New York and when I lived in Washington before that, when you live in these cities, you start to think that they're the only things that matter and the only places where anything interesting is happening. And I am here to tell you that that is absolutely not true. What is going on in Washington is incredibly important for the country. Don't get me wrong. But there are amazing things being done elsewhere. And it's important, I think, especially for journalists to spend time not just in rural areas, but places, you know, outside of New York or Washington, D.C., and see what we can learn from the rest of the country. Also living in cities around the country where people are experimenting with different ways to live, different ways to live together. I would say that for the most part, the people that we encountered, they're living according to their values. And that has led them to make very different conclusions about how they should live in the United States. And I would say, has made them happier than a lot of the rest of us that are running on the hamster wheel, if you will.
Are you still living in the van?
We're in the van now. I'm in Washington, D.C. right now visiting family, but we are still in the van traveling and hoping to encounter more communities along the way.
And where do you park it? Where do you sleep at night?
It's in Northern Virginia at a friend's house where we can get free parking. And in the city of Washington, D.C., it can be a bit expensive. However, I will tell you that we did park it not too far from the Supreme Court and slept on the streets of Capitol Hill. And because it looks like a cargo van, no one noticed. And I want to say, we've done this all across the country, essentially living mostly rent-free. It's a stealthy-looking car. It doesn't look like anything other than a van from the outside. And we've only had one police encounter the whole time.
And what was that about?
We were sleeping in a beach town in Oregon where they filmed The Goonies, and a police officer came and knocked on the door real loudly, and he told us to go to an RV park down the street. He was very kind about it, and then after the interaction, he looked up in the van and said, "You'd build this yourself? You did a nice job."
Let me ask you two questions, Chris Moody. First of all, what was the thing about living in the van that was most difficult?
Well, you can imagine a married couple moving into 72 square feet together and learning not only to live together, but living among systems that we're not used to. We, you know, had to figure out our water system and our electricity. We only have two solar panels up there, and that only allows you to turn on your lights, turn on your water, charge a cell phone, and have about one hot water boil a day for coffee. And after that, you're starting to run out of electricity. And so we adapted our lives to a much more simple life. I'll tell you, the first first week was very difficult. We were in New England, and it was cold and raining, and it was a hard time, and we had to learn to adjust. I want to say something about what it does to a husband and wife, especially for a husband. In my experience, look, even if a man and a woman are both working full-time, the data show that women do more domestic work at home. And often a husband like me can hide and only do the work that the wife asks you to do. I was probably a lazy husband. But when you live in 72 square feet with no other rooms to hide, you're either doing work and helping with the chores or you're lounging. And I learned very quickly that one couldn't lounge when someone else is working right in front of you. And so not just in building the van together, but in living in the van together, mm-hmm. we learned to work together in ways that we were never able to do in a more comfortable setting. And I think that's going to be better for us in the long run.
Okay. And then finally, what has been the worst part about adjusting back into life in the big city?
You know, when we were in the van, we did not have access to video streaming or television or entertainment like that. We spent our time together in the woods or reading books together or listening to audiobooks. It was just about as high-tech as we got. And we also didn't read the news. And that frees up your time and your mind. It really makes, I would argue, your relationship much better together. Now coming back to the real world where everyone has streaming and television or staying with family, I am so easily prone to falling right back into all of those old habits. And that has been the hardest thing, is trying to find out how to live with the values of the tiny house, the values of the van, in normal life. And I'm constantly combating not falling into my old ways because I want to keep what we learned in the van.
That is Chris Moody, who spent the last year traveling across the country while living in a 72-square-foot van with his wife. And they are writing a book about it. And the book will be called?
Maybe Life Opted Out, a 35,000-mile journey in search of a more meaningful American dream.
Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And you can see photos of Chris Moody's van, and we'll link you to his Instagram account at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
A new report finds that drive-thrus in the U.S. are slowing down. Maybe you've noticed. Joining us now is Sam Okus, editor of QSR Magazine, which covers the quick service and casual restaurant industry. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well. So when we say that drive-thrus are slowing down, some people might think, oh, that's not good. That means it's taking them longer to make the food. But as you point out, it's not necessarily about poor performance at the drive-thrus.
Yeah, that's right. It's not because the employees are bad at their jobs or taking way too long, longer than they should be. It's really because, the menus are taking longer to prepare. Customers are demanding high-quality foods. But in the case of a couple restaurants, in particular Chick-fil-A, they are so busy that it's inevitably going to take a long time. So yeah, we're seeing drive-thrus slow down in general, but a lot of factors kind of go into it, and it's not necessarily a bad thing that a restaurant would take longer to get you through the drive-thru.
Mm-hmm. Now, you looked at 10 fast food chains. What was the fastest drive-thru?
So the fastest is Dunkin'. Dunkin' did about 216 seconds on average to get you through the drive-thru.
Okay, and the slowest?
And Chick-fil-A was the slowest, and that's about 320 seconds.
And then how do the others rank?
Everybody is kind of, somewhere in the middle. Our average was 255 seconds. This was a 20-second slowdown over last year. But again, it's a lot of factors. It's busy drive-thrus. Americans love the drive-thru. And most importantly, fast food is getting better. The food is getting better, higher quality, takes longer to prepare.
When you say Americans love the drive-thru, what is the state of drive-thrus in this country today?
In general, most of the major fast food chains see about 70% of their business go through the drive-thru.
Wow. And how does that compare to years past?
That's pretty much, it holds pretty steady, but I think if anything, it's gone a little up. But these days we're seeing a little bit of a shakeup. So you have this off-premises business happening, which is referencing things like third-party delivery, Grubhub and DoorDash. You also have a lot of catering happening, takeout. You know, mobile ordering has allowed for a lot of different ways to access your fast food. So that's changing things, and I think we're going to see that affect the drive-through. And to some degree, I think we started to see that this year.
You also looked at order accuracy in this study. How are drive-throughs doing on getting orders right?
I think this one maybe surprised me a little bit more than speed of service. Order accuracy fell by 5 percentage points over last year, so it's about 84% of orders were accurate. I do want to point out Chick-fil-A was the most accurate at about 94% accurate orders. And, you know, that's really important because for as busy as Chick-fil-A, they are still top performers.
So they get the orders right. It just takes them a really long time comparatively to yeah. give you your food.
Yeah, yeah. And order accuracy, I should say, too, you know, about 15 years ago when the speed of service was really high, order accuracy was actually kind of abysmal. So order accuracy in general has gone up as the food, you know, as the restaurants have been more attentive to getting the food out accurately, but it does take a little bit more time.
Sam, one more thing. Does it make sense for drive-thrus to have one place where they give you the food and one place where you pay for the food, or is it better to put it all in one place?
That depends. You know, I think if you have a busier drive-through, sometimes it does make sense to have multiple windows. But I will tell you, with technology the way it is, Chick-fil-A and some others are sending employees out into the parking lot with tablets to take the order and take payment there to make this more efficient. So that's definitely a part of the future of drive-through too, as is, again, mobile ordering.
Put them on roller skates and it'll be like right back to the 60s.
There you go. It's Americana for you.
Sam Okus, editor of QSR Magazine, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
It's here and now. It could be the best opening of a rock song ever. My friend said, it's like Beethoven. Da-dun-dun-dun. And maybe it's the best rock band ever, arguably the best drummer. The sunshine of your love. Ginger Baker assaulting his drum kit with guitar god Eric Clapton, legendary bassist Jack Bruce on Sunshine of Your Love. The band formed in 1966, blew apart like a meteor in 68, but in between, they were cream. And Ginger Baker was his own worst enemy.
He looked like the devil.
The devil takes care of its own, yes.
Like a great virtuoso madman. Maybe you have to be a little mad to play the way he does.
Probably the greatest drummer that any of us had ever heard.
He was the hammer of the gods.
He's a force of nature.
He influenced me as a drummer, but not as a person.
The opening of the 2012 documentary Beware of Mr. Baker, which was also the sign at the entrance to Ginger Baker's home in South Africa. Ginger Baker died Sunday at 80. Filmmaker Jay Bolger became Baker's personal historian, his friend, if there was such a thing, and his punching bag. The documentary's opening scene is of Ginger Baker hitting Jay Bolger right on the nose.
Are you really going to hit me with the f***?
Well, I am. I'm going to put you in hospital.
What? Holy
I shouldn't laugh, Jay Bolger. you wrote whatever you did for Ginger Baker wasn't enough, and you owe him so much. I'm sorry for your loss, even though we're laughing here.
Oh, I don't feel worthy of condolences because I don't feel necessarily so sad. If anything, I feel, to be honest, relieved. I think he was not doing so hot.
Well, it was a life of drug abuse, smoking abuse, fights. I mean, drug abuse. He was strung out on heroin one night, went to look for his friend Jimi Hendrix, and Hendrix died.
They were doing lysergic cocaine that night, actually.
Oh, well, there you go. But let's just back up. The band Cream, you write the first supergroup of rock. Explain why.
Eric Clapton had already been called God in the Yardbirds, and Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce were amongst the musicians with Graham Bond. Graham Bond Organization was the musicians' great band in London, and I mean, mm-hmm. they were Coltrane Electric.
And again, Cream, new rock format, power trio. Here's Strange Brew. Part about Ginger Baker, Jay, that was so, he just fought with everybody, drove everybody away. What was going on there?
You know, I'm not a psychologist, but people theorize a lot of things come down to your childhood. And his childhood was defined by Nazis bombing East London and his neighborhood. And he watched his dad go off on the tracks to World War II and, you know, die in battle. And he never came back. And they just said, stiff upper lip, go forward, you know. His dad wrote him a letter that he later read, and, you know, it was kind of like a Dear John letter, and he said, use your fists, they're your best friends, son, you know. He could just keep pushing forward. He didn't like to get left behind, and whenever things felt like they were falling apart, he was quick to hit people in the face with a cane and leave them in his dust.
Yeah. Well, and we mentioned Jimi Hendrix dying. As you remind us, that shattered him. He was desperate to get clean, so he left the music scene and went to Africa and set up with the great star Fela Kuti, became revered there for his, he was called the White Drummer, and picked up polo.
Yeah, he picked up polo there. I mean, Ginger was voted by, I forgot what magazine, but least likely to survive the 70s, so the way he did it was to drive the first Range Rover ever produced from London to Lagos. And he set up shop in Lagos. And from jazz to blues to rock, and then become accepted as an African drummer was, you know, I think the real highlight of his life.
Well, let's listen to a little of Ginger Baker's live performance with Fela Kuti on Let's Start. My son, Junior, Sherry, Simeon. This is ancient history for a lot of young people who may not have heard of Cream or Ginger Baker, but Cream only lasted 2 years. He'd also later be in the supergroup Blind Faith. This was with Eric Clapton and the great Steve Winwood. Let's just listen to a little of that. Come down off your throne and leave your body alone.
I love Blind Faith. It's so great.
It's just some of the great music, but he doesn't last there because his addictions just drove away Eric Clapton.
Eric was traumatized by Ginger as much as he loved him. I mean, I could see how Ginger Baker would be terrifying.
Well, why wasn't he terrifying to you, Jay Bolger?
I don't know. I've grown up in boxing gyms my whole life in the South Bronx, and I guess I was mentally equipped. Physically, I don't like to be touched, so that was over the top when he hit me in the face. But I made him apologize, and, you know, then his wife tried to stab me, and then we had a high-speed chase, and I left the country, but whatever.
Look, you also, though, got to see his soft side. You know, he was just such a softie around his stepkids, around his horses, his dogs. Let's listen to a little of that, Ginger Baker.
I'm extremely fond of her. I think of her like she's my own.
And I wasn't studying yesterday.
She's a great little kid. And it's really nice to have a family again. If that falls apart, I really don't know what to do.
Jay Bolger, what did other drummers tell you? I mean, are we making too much of what Ginger Baker did for rock drums?
Well, I don't think he was limited to rock, and I think that's what frustrated him. I mean, he was accepted by the great African drummers of his time, from Tony Allen to Kofi Gnaba, and his idols, Max Roach, Elvin Jones, Art Blakey, mm-hmm. I just think he belongs in the Mount Rushmore of greatest drummers ever, and it annoyed him perpetually that he was in this box with John Bonham and Keith Moon, who both played in one band. Jazz is improvisational, and it involves polyrhythmic capabilities, which they weren't known for, and Ginger Baker was. So I think he was one of the greatest musicians of the 20th century, and that was how he wanted to be remembered, as opposed to, you know, a rock drummer.
Well, I tweeted out when I'd heard that he died, rest in peace, although I don't know if that's possible. but as you say, you hope he has found some peace, that is.
I think he's probably quite relieved to be on to the next life, wherever that is.
Did you win an award for Beware, Mr. Baker?
We won many awards for Beware, Mr. Baker, to which Ginger Baker told me I can shove them. He wasn't impressed, but I did read a quote from him that said that he liked the movie, although some of it was somewhat annoying.
Well, Jay Bolger, again, the movie is Beware of Mr. Baker. Ginger Baker died Sunday at 80. Jay, thank you so much for talking to us about Ginger Baker.
No worries. The devil takes care of its own. I'll sleep in this place with the lonely crowd, lie in the dark where the shadows run from themselves.
We'll have tons of videos and a link to Beware Mr. Baker at hearnow.org.
An American and two Swiss astronomers will share this year's Nobel Prize in Physics. It was announced today. James Peebles, a professor emeritus of science at Princeton. The other half of the prize will go to Michel Mayer and Didier Queloz, who conduct research in Geneva. MIT professor of planetary science Sarah Seeger joins us now to talk about their work. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So the Nobel Committee says James Peebles developed a theoretical framework that helps us understand the history of the universe. What does that mean?
How the universe came to be and what happened after it first formed, how it evolved from this hot, dense state initially to galaxies and planets today is what Jim really wrote about.
And how did he take the science further than it had already been before?
Well, before, we literally had no theory. There was nothing written down like equations that could describe how the universe evolved. And he's the one who put all those equations down on paper.
Basically, we look up at the sky, we can see what we can see, but he basically made it a mathematical equation that we could figure out why things were where they are.
Exactly. Like, I could give you one concrete example if you'd like.
Yeah.
So in the early universe, it was hot and we had no atoms or molecules. They were just protons and electrons floating around. And he wrote down how those electrons and protons combined over what time scale to form the atoms, the first atoms that were out in our universe.
And why is it so important for us to know that?
We always want to know where we came from. Why are we here? And cosmology helps to address that question in a very scientific way.
What about the work of Michel Mayor and Didier Queloz? They discovered the first exoplanet. First of all, what is an exoplanet?
Well, an exoplanet is a planet that orbits a star other than the sun. All stars are suns. And it certainly makes sense if our sun has planets, including Earth, that these other stars should have planets also, and they do.
So we're not an exoplanet, though. We're just a planet.
We're just a planet to us. But if there are intelligent creatures on another planet orbiting another star looking back at our sun, then they would call us an exoplanet.
So how did these two scientists discover the first exoplanet?
Well, they discovered it using a technique. It has a very jargony name. It's called radial velocity. And essentially what they're doing is they're using the concept that a star moves if there's a planet around it. You could say the planet orbits the star and tugs on the star. Kind of more accurate view is the planet and star orbit the common center of mass. So the star is wobbling. And they actually measured the line of sight motion of the star. Tiny movement away from us and towards us as that planet orbited the star.
And they didn't actually observe the exoplanet they discovered.
They didn't observe the exoplanet. They just see the effect the planet has indirectly on its host star.
What does it tell you that this year the Nobel Prize in Physics went to this kind of research?
It's absolutely phenomenal, but it tells me that the Nobel Prize Committee may have some more flexibility than at least I thought, because by the way, this morning when I looked at the news and saw exoplanets had won the Nobel, I was speechless. I was floored because I thought the Nobel Prize in Physics was severely limited to new physics, fundamental physics. And exoplanets is really just applied physics. We take physics that has existed for hundreds of years and we apply it to discoveries. We apply it to planets, mm-hmm. planetary systems. In my mind, what it means is that a field that 25 years ago was obscure and fringe and laughable. It was crazy. People didn't think it was real. And now today it's Nobel worthy. So it means that the field has come a long way and, let's say, matured, if you will, into something that people consider to be highly valuable.
So this is your area of research as well. What is left to be discovered building on the work of these now Nobel Prize winning
scientists? Well, there's so much more to do. We don't really understand how planets formed and evolved exactly. And by the way, I just want to say that when 51 Peg B was discovered, I was a graduate student at Harvard University.
That's the name of the exoplanet.
Yes, the name of the exoplanet is 51 Peg B. We don't have very great names for it. Like, we couldn't name it Jeremy name it Boston or something. We just have to name it after its star. So when the planet was first discovered, I was in graduate school. And just about 5 or 6 months later, I started working on exoplanets. And at the time, and even now, I work on, one of the things I work on is exoplanet atmospheres. And so while we have lots of planets, thousands of planets, exoplanets that we know about, we now want to learn more about the individual planets. We're also at the same time pushing towards smaller and smaller planets. 51 Peg B is like a bizarre world. It's not very common, but it's a giant planet so close to the star. It's like 10 times closer to its star than Mercury is to our sun. We're looking for planets more like home.
Is it still easiest to look deep into space with some kind of telescope, or is it easier now to use other ways of finding out what's out there?
Well, the astronomer's toolkit goes far beyond telescopes
right,
you think about,
right.
like the kind you'd look through with your eye or use an instrument. We have everything from X-ray telescopes in space all the way to much longer wavelengths like radio wavelengths. Mm-hmm. So we use the full...
And gravitational waves.
And
now.
Gravitational waves are part of
which
our
toolkit. Which just won a Nobel not too long ago, right?
Exactly.
I just want to quote something that Dr. Peebles, one of the winners, said to reporters today. He said, "You should enter it for the love of the science. The prizes and awards, they're charming, very much appreciated, but that's not part of your plans. You should enter science because you're fascinated by it. That's what I did." You know him. What do you make of that line that he just said to reporters today?
It sounds just like him, just like what I'd expect. He's a very humble, very nice, very good person.
That's Sarah Seeger, who's a professor of planetary science at MIT, talking with us today about the winners of the Nobel Prize in Physics. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And tomorrow it's chemistry's turn.
Yeah, there you go.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.